Now we're recording, Brendan. See the big smile on your face. Great to see you, my friend. How are you?
And you, fella. Yeah, I'm doing well today. Had a nice meeting this morning. Random free thinkers. Always a good start to a Saturday.
Yeah, 11 a.m. Irish time, 6 a.m. Eastern, and 3 a.m. Pacific.
Look at that. What a lovely plug for 9
p.m. AEST as well. Fucking, there you go. I know it is a great meet. Great meet.
Yeah.
But sure, it's the company you keep, Brendan. It's people like me and Don and Roger.
That's it. But I wouldn't have said that in case you get a big head, but it's too late now.
My head will always look normal compared to yours, though. Now, how are you doing, my friend? How many more days till retirement, can I ask?
Mm-hmm.
How many more days till retirement?
I don't know how many days, but I do know that I've got less than 70 night shifts until I hang up my boots next year.
Fantastic, my friend. Yeah. Fantastic.
It's going to be late next year before I do retire.
You want to tell us about yourself, where you grew up?
Well, as you know, I'm from the northwest of Ireland, a Leitrim boy, North Leitrim.
And, the original Leitrim boy.
I'm the original Leitrim boy. That's it, yeah. Yeah, so, yeah, I'm the youngest of a very big family. I'm the baby of 12 and good Irish Catholic family, the classic. But I never felt that I was part of such a very, very large family because I was born in 65, so a lot of my family, like there's 21 years between me and my eldest brother. So a lot of my family had actually left home by the time I'd come along. So a lot of people assume that I was brought up in a home that was chaotic with so many kids running around, but that's actually not the case. There was actually a lot less of us actually left by the time I came around. So it was quite quiet, really, that I can remember.
So 21 was the age gap between you and the eldest. What was the one nearest to you?
21 years, yeah.
16 between me and my sister.
Yeah.
It's mad because, like you're saying there, they had different lives, you know what I mean? Like, to them, you know what I mean?
Yeah, they did, but it never feels that way. People always think that you've got something quite explicit to give or something unusual, but for me, what might sound unusual or different to people isn't, because of course once you've lived that life, that's all you know, that's all I knew. So it didn't feel, it's now more than anything else that I look back and I think, oh, that's nice. Like my eldest brother, the one who's 21 years older, he's not just my brother, but he's a great friend as well. If anything, we've been getting closer over the years because his kids have now left home. He's many years retired from his job, so it gives him more time, if you like, to not just be with his own family and grandkids, but it gives him more time to be with his own siblings as well. So we're actually, I find that I'm getting closer to that end of the family than I might ever have been in the past. That's the only difference I could say, if you could call it a difference. But as a kid growing up, that was my older brother. Didn't make any difference to me, you know. That's all I knew.
Did you idolize him? I used to look up to my brother Michael like he was a fucking god.
Two of them, without a shadow of doubt. Not the eldest, again, because of, you know, a lot of them had left home. They were living over in the UK where I'm living now. I'm living in London. So a lot of them had left. In terms of kind of idolatry and all that, I mean, there was two of them who I would have looked up to a great deal, a huge amount. My dad died when I was only 14. So at that point, one of them, whether he wanted it or not, he had just come back from England that year. He'd lived over here in the UK for 12 years. And he came back in 1979 to Ireland. Our dad died in December of that year. So when my dad died, that brother I became very close with. And effectively, whether he liked it or not, I latched on to him. And fortunately, he was in business himself. So he was able to help my mum out a lot. So that was helpful. That was useful. That's the closest I would have come to idolizing anyone. Because again, when you're in family situations, you see everything that happens, you see everything that goes on. I'm not quite even sure that idolizing is the best word to describe it. Not in the same way as you look at your favorite footballers and you see them scoring a goal, so that's all you know them for, scoring goals on the pitch. You think they get put back into a little glass box after that, covered in cotton wool.
Your family could have had a football team, couldn't they? 12.
Yeah, they could. Yeah, definitely could.
No United fan, aren't you?
Just one stuff.
You're a United fan, aren't you?
Yeah, Manchester United. Just to make that clear, in case anyone gets it confused with Leeds United or any of the other Uniteds.
No, you should have been a Leeds fan, really, wouldn't you? You're of that age group and you're Irish. That's what you should be.
Yeah, well, there was a couple of kids that was in my village that were around the same age as me that were Leeds fans as well. The only thing I liked about Leeds was they had nice badges that you could sew onto your Wrangler, the Wrangler jackets. I think you're far too young even to remember them, are you?
I do know what they are, yeah.
Yeah.
Nice. Yes. What did someone say to me the other day? It's like, yeah, you better shut up, kid. I've got clothes older than you. I'm like, you should probably throw them out.
Which is probably true. Yeah. But in terms of what we're probably the reason we got together today, in terms of drinking and all that, people always assume that A, being Irish, and second, big families, that there was always lots and lots of drink, but that was not the case with my family. We did not have drink in the house, even during Christmas and times like that. There was never a booze in the house. And the few people that were drinking, it seemed that they couldn't handle their alcohol, and it was a taboo subject. I think grandparents, but I can't be 100% sure. I think some of my grandparents may have had, certainly great-grandparents. One of them, I think, owned a pub in Ballyshannon in County Donegal. And I think the story goes that he drank himself out of that. I never asked and I never delved into the full details of it. But in terms of my own immediate family growing up, drink was something that wasn't looked upon as helpful or useful. And I hated it. I hated what alcohol did to people. And I was, you may have heard me say this before, I was adamant that I would never drink. I was absolutely, you know, if one of the few things that I was sure about, that was that I would never drink. So picking up my first drink was almost like a shock. I wanted to keep it a secret, both to myself and to everyone else. It's almost like I knew I was putting myself on the naughty step from day one. I just knew it was not something that was right for me. Because from the get-go, I got drunk anyway when I drank.
What age were you?
I was 16, so I wasn't that young. By comparison to what you hear some people say, some kids 13, 14 when they start the first one.
You didn't have it in but the house, 16. Though, so it's a little bit more.
You know. Yeah,
but you had mates probably had trip. It before you.
School yeah, trip. I mean, like, some of my friends did, yeah. I mean, that's it. I mean, the funny thing was, coming maybe from a big family, some of my friends were older than me as well, even then. Even when I was 13, 14, I did hang around with kids, some my age, but it was again, because it's a small village where I came from, some of them were in their like late teens, and I was the only one that didn't drink. And that's why, to me, it was easy not to drink. It never ever occurred to me that I would drink, and I seen what it did to them as well. Even like at 13 or 14, I was kind of like sensible enough not to drink, seeing what it did. So going on the school trip and drinking was, you know, that was it. And I was off. I was off. That was it. Once I started, I was off every Friday. Every Friday.
Did you smoke fags or whatever? Cigarettes?
Never smoked. That's why I laugh. I said I'd never smoke and never drink. That's the gang we were in school, although we weren't, when I say gang, the group of kids we hung around with, we were in that group that didn't smoke. I think the class that were ahead of us smoked and the ones below me smoked, but we were in a group that we didn't smoke. And that was it. It was cool not to smoke as opposed to smoking.
What was your first drink then on the school trip or tour?
Yeah, it was on the school trip. I'll never forget it.
Where did you go?
Went into a North license. We went to Amsterdam in Holland.
Nice. And you never smoked.
Oh, I would love everyone.
I didn't know you went to fucking Amsterdam. I said, who the fuck gets to go to Amsterdam? In what the?
There you go. From the 80s. I'd been on a jet before I'd even been on a train. I always laugh, and I ended up working in an industry, the rail industry, for 35 years now. But yeah, so yeah, some of my friends went in and got.
We're calling you the foxy man behind your back, you know that?
Sorry.
We're calling you the foxy man behind your back.
The foxy man. Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, that's right. You have to let people. We'll explain that. It's because I managed to film a fox on the top of a London Underground train a couple of months ago, I think it was. It's on YouTube, anyway, if anyone wants to see it.
It's funny, because I was talking to you that day, and it's like, see this fucker here? You see this fucker? And I'm like, what are you on about? It's like, oh, I didn't send you the video yet, did I?
I ran ahead of myself.
Yeah, no, it's cool, yeah, cool video. Excited. And no, look, it's a nice picture as well, sorry. So you went from Leitrim to Amsterdam, never on a train. Leitrim. All of a sudden, you're in Amsterdam. What year is that? 80s?
81, I'm guessing. 81 or 82. Either 81 or 82. So, yeah. So my mates, they didn't think they'd get served, but they went into an off-license or whatever the equivalent they call it in Amsterdam, and they got cans of Heineken. And then two more worked up the courage to go in. And then I'm not very tall. So, and then at that time, I didn't have gray hair, obviously. They didn't think I'd get served. So I was the last to go in. And I asked for the two cans of Heineken, and I got served. And the bigger guys were really disappointed. they thought I was going to get refused. So there was that thing as well that, I felt good. But I don't know. I think, when I think about it, I did it because the rest of them were doing it. I don't think it had anything to do with wanting to drink or wanting to even experiment with it or anything like that. I just did it. I was high. I was really excited about being out of Ireland for the first time in my life. School trip, getting to Amsterdam and all the excitement around that. That was more of it, as opposed to wanting to get alcohol. It never occurred to me that that's what we were going to be doing. Walking down the street.
What was the idea of going to Amsterdam?
To be honest, I guess it was just the school I went to was a comprehensive, and they decided to start.
Yeah, Protestant school.
No. It was multi denominational. Multi denominational.
You were telling me once before that you got a kiss off an old Protestant girl. Fair play to you.
Oh, bless her. Well, I say again, the first girl that I kissed, we were 8. Yes, I kissed her on the side of the cheek. And her mum, that was on another school trip from the school I went to. And her mum found out. And I think she started to cry because her mum got upset. I was the only little Catholic boy on the trip. I was the only Catholic that was in that school up in the northwest of Ireland. And that's a long story. I won't go into that. It might bore you. But So she started to cry. Jane started to cry. The lovely Jane. And
8 years old and you're stealing kisses, by Jesus.
There you go. There you go. You can see it. You can see. You can see.
Turned her fucking head. I was going for the kill.
I was destined to be trouble. Was it just that I had a deep fondness for and love of others? It's a nicer way.
What sort of women do you like? Annie. What's my favorite drink? My next one.
You know what I mean? Okay. Exactly.
A guy that died a few years ago from one of that, and you'd ask him, how do you like your eggs with a second one? So Jesus, Jane, huh? Nice. But how long did you go to like Amsterdam for? What was the story there?
That was just a 3-day trip. And well, it was nice to see Amsterdam when you're 16 years of age. And of course, when you're 16 on a school trip, you look and see the things we went. They brought us to some museums, and we've seen that beautiful painting, Rembrandt's Night Watch. I can remember that. I've been to see it since. And we went to The Hague, which is a beautiful. The Hague, of course, is the capital of the Netherlands. It's a much smaller city and more of a large town, like a provincial town. And it's beautiful. The Hague is very nice. But yeah, I guess the reason we ended up going there was it was just a 1 hour flight from Dublin. And it was on mainland Europe, so it was probably going to be there or Paris. So it just happened to be Amsterdam that we went to. And that was it. Two cans of Heineken and I was off.
We got to go up to Derry when I was in school. The lads above us, they went to Spain about 3 or 4 years before us. The last trip Balahale ever went to, man. They ruined it for everyone else. Mayhem.
That's sometimes what happens, I guess. It's difficult for school management and for the teachers to decide what's the best thing to do, because they don't want to micromanage the young people when they're going abroad. But by the same token, if you get one or two strong characters in the group that might lead them down the wrong way, that's what happens. But it was a nice trip. It was a good trip, and I would say as well that I had always had a fascination from I was a kid with other countries and cultures and things like that. Although it's very difficult nowadays to consider that. Even when you do go abroad, when you go to cities especially, it's not possible to really immerse yourself in the culture. It's cities especially are the same on this. But I did. I mean, I can remember as a kid drawing pictures of countries and then sort of talking about the costumes they wore and the food that they ate and all that. Yeah. That's one of the nice things about living, well, I suppose anywhere nowadays. Again, doesn't matter where you live, but certainly in London, you get such a diversity in terms of what's on offer. It's a pity I often think it's a shame that people don't see it that way for what it is. That the diversity offers you the opportunity to delve into so many things. It's fantastic.
Exactly. You know? Food is amazing, man, because it does transport, you know, where it's like you're eating something. It's like, oh, that reminds me of that time in Spain or fucking.
That's right. And get behind,
brought
yeah.
to different.
Yeah. Exactly. And behind the food, then there's always the backstory to certain things and stories. And it's lovely. You know, my partner is her parents were from Gujarat in India, although she was born in Uganda. She still considers herself culturally very much an Indian. And it's wonderful to be able to see certain things. And certainly food is one of the dominant things in that culture. But other things as well, how they celebrate their weddings, even the way that they say goodbye to their loved ones when they pass on is very colourful. And even though someone like myself who's an atheist, I think in terms of how they do it, they really do celebrate the life of the person. It's wonderful. It's absolutely fantastic.
You see that show Rituals? My friend from Cork sent me it. It's on the RTE player. It's really good. No, man. It's fucking... all different types of, I can't remember any of the countries right now, but like the way you were on about like the debt and the life, and there was Burning Man, was it like episode 4? And it's a great little show. It's, you know, when you're watching something and like 30 or 40 seconds in, you just catch your phone and just fuck it to the side. And it's like, I don't care. This is me for an hour and a half now. This is all I'm doing. Yeah. And then all of a sudden you turn your phone on and there's been like a fucking... like 300 messages.
Oh, shit. I'm not as popular as you, so I mean, I'd never have that many.
Okay, maybe I exaggerated. Maybe 150.
There you go. You see, I'm still not as popular as that.
You always like traveling, though? In the sense you're talking about Vietnam earlier.
Yeah, well, actually, it was funny because before... the UK went into lockdown, which I think was the 26th of March last year. I had just got back from Vietnam. I had 3 weeks out there. I got back on the 13th of March. And it was one of the... well, it was lovely. It was a wonderful trip because Vietnam had stopped people traveling from China, South Korea, and Japan, but they were allowing people from Western Europe, the United States, and other parts of the world. So it was very quiet. What might normally be, certainly the tourist areas, extremely busy. They were very quiet. So access and to things were much easier. So I actually had parts of Hanoi, Da Nang, Hoi An, and down the south then, Ho Chi Minh City. We had it to ourselves. It was wonderful. So where you might normally have to queue up to see certain things, we didn't have any of that. And everything was available. To see anything that was worth seeing was available. But yeah, it's a strange thing as well. Just before I went to Vietnam, I wasn't very excited about the trip, which kind of left me disappointed. I was probably doing too much traveling. I was taken for granted. I was losing the mojo for it.
There's a lot of just Irish before I listen left, to this going, yeah. Oh, poor Brendan. Oh.
Yeah, I know that sounds crazy, doesn't it? It does sound ridiculous, and that's what I mean. I think
it just feeling the best though, were you?
Sorry?
You weren't feeling the best though, sir.
No, I was okay. Yeah. No, but what I'm saying either. I wasn't as excited about the upcoming trip as I would have thought it might have been 10 or 15 years ago. I was probably maybe doing too much traveling in one sense. I wasn't giving myself time to digest and enjoy what I'd already done. You know, if there was the chance of booking a flight, I'd be on the internet booking a flight somewhere.
Taking that for granted anymore, are we?
Yeah, that's exactly it. Taking it for granted and not savoring what was on offer. Because the year before, I think I'd been to Thailand. And that was a nice trip as well. Didn't have as long there as I would have liked to. That's a place I'd like to go back to as well. Oh, yeah.
It's Jude that sent me that picture before, and Tommy running out of the room shouting, "It's a boy! It's a boy!" And we never returned to Thailand.
Oh, yeah.
No, someone sent me a letter. It just sounds like something you might send me.
Oh yeah, there's a joke about that, but I don't think it's for airing to anyone that might be listening to this podcast.
I wouldn't mind, you're quite funny. Tell me this, lad. Do you believe it, like it's a genetic disease, or do you believe it's just progressive, or
it's quite interesting.
Some hard hitting questions.
No, I always thought that I read a book once when I wasn't that long around AA, and it was a book, believe it or not, that a guy had written about the number of people through history that were probably alcoholics. And I can't remember the name of the book or anything. And he was talking about Henry VIII, and that a lot of Henry VIII's actions and behaviors would have probably suggested that he was an alcoholic, along with some other very famous people. And but the guy described it, and I've always remembered it, is that he said that people were predisposed to that, you know, kind of a genetic, and an inherited vulnerability. That was it, an inherited vulnerability to alcoholism. So I kind of latched on to that because of some of my family history. Having said that, in the last 12 months, especially listening to so many people from across the world, I still think that I did have an inherited vulnerability. But then who hasn't, I think, in many ways? I heard a wonderful chair this morning, and it was very obvious from the person that they'd had a lot of trauma in their life. And so they turned to alcohol to ease a lot of the pain and the angst around much of the trauma they had. So I think that in addition to possibly being disposed to it, that sometimes people can nurture the illness as well. I heard a wonderful guy, he's passed away since. He worked in one of the clinics in the United States. He was a doctor originally from Dublin, his wife's a very well-known actress in the United States. And he did a wonderful workshop in Spain at a convention. I was at years ago. And he talked about that for alcoholics that would be predisposed, that when they have a drink and they have sufficient amount of drink in the body, that it's almost like a default switch in some part of the brain. I mean, he would have been getting into the neuroscience of it and not too deep at the time for the workshop because we were all lay people there. But he spoke about a default switch and it remains there and it can never be corrected. Now, how far, that's about 15 years ago, how far neuroscience and the understanding of alcoholism and addiction in general has gone since that, I'm not too sure. It's certainly something worth looking up. But yeah, that's the way he explained it. And it was fascinating to listen to him to talk about some of the, not just the psychological things that happen, but the neuroscience and the biological and physiological things that happen in our body. But to answer your question, to summarize it, I think I certainly had the inherited vulnerability to it. And that was it. I was away, you know.
But so you never grew up with it in the house, and then you were saying you wanted to stay away from it? Like, was there many pubs in your village or your street, or like, what was your neighborhood like, in a sense? Like, if it turned you off it, but then all of a sudden you get to Amsterdam and you kind of, like you said, you got high from the idea. The fact you got served, you said you weren't that tall. How tall are you? Because I've been telling someone you're at least 6 foot. I can tell by the look of you.
From me, there. What was that?
You're for freezing, eh?
Don't know if it's me or you.
You hear me okay?
Yeah, I can hear you again now. Yeah, sorry. Say that again, Mark.
So, if you were turned off it. Oh, yeah. Thanks, Jimmy. I don't know. Sorry. So, like, in the sense you didn't like the idea of going drinking, but then all of a sudden you went to Amsterdam and that's where you had your first kind of drink. Why were you so off the idea or whatever? Like, you thought to yourself, like what you've seen in the neighborhood or just growing up?
No, within my family.
Right.
One or two siblings in particular. And my late father drank as well. And I sometimes feel a little unfair. The man's over 40 years past now. But he drank, and he certainly wasn't he wasn't nasty or anything. In fact, if anything, he was mellower when he'd have a few drinks, but he couldn't handle his drink, and he certainly didn't drink to have two or three drinks. When my father drank, he drank to get drunk, always. And he was, if you can imagine, he was in his early 60s when I was quite young, and my mother used to worry about him from his health. He wasn't in the best of health. So when he drank, it was very clear that he wasn't doing any good to his body. And it was a worry. It was a worry for my mum. And that, in a sense, kind of, I was worried about it as well. And I guess when you're a kid like that, but not just my dad, you know, and without telling other people's stories, which is not for me to talk about, even members of my family, but I seen what it was doing. Good, decent people, good people who I cared for and loved, and I hated to see what alcohol did to them. And it wasn't every day, and it wasn't even every week. But if there were, if you like, episodes, there were something that definitely made me sit up and recognize the fact that alcohol was the common denominator, if you like, for causing some problems. And I was quite certain I never would. I was absolutely certain I never would. In fact, I should say as well, latch on, that I think other people's situations as they were drinking saved me from a lot of issues, because you know yourself, we're crafty. When we're drinking, we have to have our minds running at 100% sometimes to get around certain situations. But there were also things going on in my life where I knew I couldn't push the boundaries. I could not push the boundaries because at least my family had had enough intolerance, if you like, to certain things that I knew certain things wouldn't be tolerated. But that's all that did was made me play games. So if I came down from Dublin, I worked in Dublin when I was in my late teens, early 20s. So if I came from Dublin, I was a little bit more conscious of the fact that I couldn't drink that much. Didn't always stop me. But I was certainly more of a rip-roaring drunk when I was away from the village that I came was brought up in, if that's making sense. So I was I was a bit more careful about what I would be doing. Because I knew anyway that even though some people in my family, particularly my mum, my late mum, bless her, she would always say, you're destroying yourself with drink. Even though I thought I was drinking less, she'd say to me sometimes, you are destroying yourself with drink, be careful. And it was less, as I say, when I was back home than when I was in Dublin. I got myself into some rare old scrapes when I was drinking.
Yeah. You want to talk about any of them? You go mad in Dublin, you just start to array with a few Jackeens.
There's two things, there's two stories that always come to mind, and one of them is one I shared, I think, at my second meeting. I think at my very second AA meeting, it was something I always needed to get off my chest. I was kind of straight in there doing the confessional, and it was I worked with a lady who was, I'm 5'4", but I worked with this lovely lady.
Really?
Her name was Elaine.
Jeez, I would have put a foot on you.
Okay, right, you see, and her name was Elaine. I believe her surname might have been. You see, Elaine Dunn, I think, was her name, and maybe I shouldn't be saying her name, but she was 6 foot, and I fell head over heels with Elaine, and we were drinking. She taught me to actually drink Guinness with whiskey chasers when I worked in County Wicklow. So we'd go out and we'd drink. I worked for her on the post office that time. And so Elaine had a boyfriend, but he wasn't a particularly nice guy. So I left a nightclub at about 1 o'clock in the morning in Bray in County Wicklow one Saturday night. And I met Elaine's boyfriend, and I proceeded to tell him that he really wasn't good enough for Elaine, and that she'd be better off with me, or words to that effect. And surprisingly, he didn't agree with me.
Yeah.
So his way of communicating his disagreement was to give me one good thump across the jaw, and I just fell to the floor. And I think the poor guy got a terrible fright, because you'll see there's a good 2-inch scar underneath my chin. Well, I've got a double chin now, so it's probably not as easy to see, but I got quite a bad injury. And he's seen the damage that had been done. So the poor guy actually helped me to my feet, as drunk as I was. And he brought me and left me at my doorstep to where I was living, the apartment I was living in Bray in County Wicklow. But because of the job I was doing, I was off sick for about 2 weeks from work. I mean, my face was a mess. It was swollen up. And actually, there's a little side story to this. When I went back home to Leitrim, my uncle, who was alive at the time, came to my house. And I opened the door, and I did look a little like Elephant Man. I really did not look very good. And he turned around, he was from Northern Ireland, and he went, "Oh my God, what happened to you?" He says, "Did you cut yourself shaving?" I would have had to have been shaving with a hatchet, I think. But anyway, that's a side to the story. That in terms of what happened, when I went back to work.
Her name is Eileen, you should have said back to her.
I went back to work. I worked, as I said, for Impost. And the postmaster, who really wasn't very fond of me at all, because, I mean, I was quite a little troublemaker as well from, he didn't like me. And he asked me what happened. So I wasn't going to tell him exactly the story. And I'm laboring this story, I'm sorry. But anyway, I told him that I was set upon, and I didn't say one or two, I said three or four young kids. And I didn't want to say they were big guys, because as I said, I'm not a big guy. And that time I was a lot even slimmer that time. And so I said there was three or four young kids, about 15 or 16. And they set upon me when I was coming home from this nightclub at 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. And they beat me up. So he kind of believed me, but he didn't, if you know what I mean. But the worst part of it was my best friend who I worked with, I told him the story and I made up that story to him as well. And he came from Bray and Wicklow. And then about 2 weeks later, he came into the pub all triumphant to say that he and his friends had actually recognized the kids down the front, the seafront, from the descriptions I had given. And they were they carried out a court. So they inflicted damage on these poor four kids that had never done any harm to me. So that was one of the first, that was one story. And I tell it because of A, I felt so guilty for the kids. And secondly, because I've got the mark on my face to show it. That's one of many little stories that I could tell.
Nice.
There was another story.
No, I didn't do it. Of course you'd say that.
You know what? I must admit as well that I had to check with myself whether the story was true. And I think even now, if I'm not careful, sometimes I forget that the true story was that what actually happened, the guy that didn't agree with me about going out with Elaine. Because I had been so creative in explaining the story over and over again about the kids that because that's what I told my family as well. It was four young kids. And the reason why that story was plausible, by the way, is because, you know, this is a good laugh. I was a TV license inspector. I hope that hasn't given anyone resentment. But I was a nice TV license inspector. I let most people off. So it seemed to marry up okay that somebody recognized me for the job I was doing.
Yeah. There he is. That's the prick. Oh, Christ.
Bet you're sorry you asked now.
No, I'm delighted, man. I was telling someone before though, one of my favorite stories is we were buying drink. We'd like knew you'd come along and you'd get it for us or whatever, or someone else would come along, yeah. But every now and again, you'd have to chance your arm with someone, you know. And we gave this money to one lad, yeah, and he came out there and he was smoking a box of, you know, fags and cigarettes. I goes, where's our drink? And he goes, fuck off. And he just keeps walking. I hated that lad for years, man, yeah. But yeah, I think about painful. It sometimes, I'm like, genius. Fucking genius. Well, whatever.
I used to keep resentments like that. If I bought somebody around, if I was buying around and I bought somebody a drink that was in and they left, you know, I had a memory like an elephant, you know. I could spend copious amounts of money on silly things, but if somebody didn't buy me a drink back, it was a great, great excuse to go and have another drink. It was always a very useful resentment to have. But deep down, I was probably delighted that I had an excuse.
So I was talking to Seamus about that before. You haven't met him yet. That'll be a good day. Why did we buy drinks for other people?
I was a massive people pleaser anyway. And the more people I could not bring Seamus. Into the circle.
Seamus didn't give a fuck.
We bought drinks, I suppose, to make the
misery loves company.
Sometimes to make what was probably not really, I'm not going to say socially acceptable, because of course it's socially acceptable to go out and have a few drinks. But if you wanted to bring people into your circle and ensnare them and keep them there, it was making what was a little bit unnatural, a bit more natural to kind of appease your own mind. If you can get people to drink with you at the same level, then it makes it seem normal. I would think that would be just one of the reasons. And of course, as you get drunker and drunker, anyway, you get a little bit more benevolent, don't you? You know, it's a kind of let's all live for today. Que sera, sera, you know. And if you can make them your friends, and it only costs a drink, then all the better. But I would say probably the main thing is people pleasing, because I very rarely got myself into big rounds where I wasn't watching. I would have to be very drunk not to watch who wasn't buying me a drink back. Just part of the craziness is now as well.